It's my distinct honor this morning to introduce the Leland Blanchard Lecture. As you know, Leland Blanchard was a charter member of STFM, its second president, and an early pioneer of family medicine. This lecture is held during the STFM annual meeting each year to honor him and all of the principles and foundations of those who've come before us to help us understand how important family medicine is and to continue to motivate us to meet the changing needs of the healthcare environment in which we are. I am absolutely delighted to introduce our Leland Blanchard Memorial Lecturer this morning, and that is Kamara Phyllis Jones, who's the current president of the American Public Health Association and a fellow of the Satcher Health Leadership Institute and the Cardiovascular Research Institute and Morehouse School of Medicine. It is really an honor for us to have someone of the vision and prominence of Dr. Jones here. Ironically, I don't think this was planned, Dr. Jones received her medical degree from Stanford University, so I'm sure she's going to make a comment about that. And went on and got her master's in public health and her PhD in epidemiology from Johns Hopkins School of Hygiene and Public Health. And then she completed her residency training with Janet Townsend as her program director at the program in social medicine at Montefiore Hospital in New York in the Bronx. So she has some real ties to many of us here. She has been on the faculty of the Harvard School of Public Health and a medical officer for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And I came to know Kamara years ago when she was at the CDC and some of the work she did with the Association of Black Cardiologists. She's renowned for describing the social determinants of health, including poverty and neighborhood conditions, and addressing the social determinants of equity, especially including racism and all of those other systems of structural inequity. She's helped to shape the discussion of racism as a social determinant of equity and a root cause of racial and ethnic differences in health outcomes. Dr. Jones is one of the things I always remember about her was she was one of the first people to describe the three levels of racism: institutionalized, personally mediated, internalized, and illustrated those three levels in her metaphor about a gardener's tale, and I would definitely encourage you to read about that. And I use that a lot when I teach, so she's always in my mind. She'll generalize her discussion of racism to encompass all of those other areas of structured inequity. She later led the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination and developed an organizing tool for addressing the impacts of racism on health and well-being. She really prompts us to ask ourselves, what are our experiences? How is racism potentially operating here? And how do we organize to address it? To go from that passive role to an active role. So, Kamara Phyllis Jones, currently the president of the American Public Health Association. We've been fortunate to get her in a very busy schedule. She came in late last night after storms in DC. It joined us on the fun run this morning. So she's really all in with us, folks. So she deserves a lot of encouragement from us. So I want to make sure that you listen to her as she talks about her leadership in the national campaign to combat racism. And please join me in welcoming our 2016 Blanchard Memorial Lecturer.
Wow. Good morning, everyone. It's my real pleasure to be here in a room full of family physicians who are training other family physicians. It's great. I as president of the American Public Health Association, am actually launching a national campaign against racism. I used to say that my, thank you, yes. I used to say that my work was to start a conversation, a national conversation on racism that would, in my children's generation, become a national campaign against racism. And then I got this amazing opportunity, this amazing bully pulpit, if you will, of the presidency of the American Public Health Association. So I realized that APHA by itself cannot dismantle this system. And certainly, even if it could, it would not be in the 1 year that I'm president. So this is a call to action. It's an agenda setting thing. It's a call for us to name racism, ask how is racism operating here, and organize and strategize to act. And so as I share with you some tools, I don't know how this got back here like this, but
Hold on for a second.
Let me just do all of this. As I share with you some tools, As I share with you some tools for a national campaign against racism, I'm doing this not only for you to use these tools in your own work, but to use these in your communities, because what we really need to do is to, especially in this time, today, you know, tonight we're going to be looking at the news and looking at more election returns, and it's a very troubling time in our nation. So I want us all to be all in. But when I talk about racism, many people would ask, why would I as a physician be talking about racism at all? So the first tool I'm going to share with you is a tool for contextualizing different levels of health intervention. So here we go. I do it in my cliff analogy. And here we start out. Do, 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 do. Whoops! Boom! Somebody just fell off of the cliff of good health. Right? And if that were you or me, we would be delighted to find an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff to speed us on to care. But if we were concerned about others who might come along that cliff face, if we were concerned about community health, population health, public health, we might well ask ourselves, what could we put in place besides stationing lots of ambulances at the bottom of the cliff as a health intervention, right? Somebody in this room is going to say, I know. Let's put a net halfway down, because even if people fall, we can catch them before they get crunched up at the bottom. And that's a great idea. Except, you know, nets have holes in them, so some people might fall through the cracks. So maybe we need to make that a trampoline halfway down the cliff, right? No holes in a trampoline. But even if we had a trampoline halfway down that cliff, we might find ourselves with lots of people just bouncing up and down at half functionality, not able to get back to the top of the cliff. So, what else could we put in place as a health intervention? Well, clearly we need to be thinking about a fence at the edge of the cliff to keep people from falling in the first place. But even that has to be a really, really strong fence if there's a lot of population pressure against it. So, what else can we do as a health intervention? Well, we can move the population away from the edge of the cliff. So I'm going to label the interventions that I've described so far, where the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff clearly represents medical care and what we on the public health side of the room describe as tertiary prevention. You know, we talk about three levels of prevention: primary, secondary, tertiary, where tertiary prevention is preventing complications from disease that's already manifest. For example, preventing amputations from diabetes. So that's our ambulance. The net, or trampoline halfway down, these are our safety net programs, which could be in our social services, as well as secondary prevention, early detection, all of our screening programs. You know, cancer screening, all of these are about that net. The fence represents primary prevention, keeping things from happening in the first place. It could be immunizations, it could be strengthening families and structures. And moving the population away from the edge of the cliff is what many people are describing now as addressing the social determinants of health, the determinants of health and illness that are outside of the individual, beyond our genes and beyond our individual behaviors. And in fact, these social determinants of health are the context in which our behaviors arise and in which they convey risk or protection. So they include individual contexts like individual education, occupation, income, wealth, poverty or wealth. They include neighborhood conditions, whether you can get fresh fruits and vegetables in your neighborhood to eat 5 to 9 servings a day, whether it is safe for you to even walk outside to get your 30 minutes of exercise, whether you have jobs in your neighborhood, or even transportation to a job that's outside of your neighborhood. What are the environmental conditions? What are your occupational exposures and the like? What are the quality of the schools? And so this diagram actually could be quite useful in a community conversation about how should we be investing in health. I think everyone would agree that we need some of all of it, right? But it's a matter of emphasis. We could take this to a community meeting. People could all be all in. Well, I think we need to be doing a little bit more of the fence, and this is what our fence should look like, et cetera, et cetera. We could go to Congress. But as useful as the diagram might be for starting this kind of conversation, there's a huge fatal flaw in what I've presented so far. And the huge fatal flaw is that so far, I have not talked about how health disparities arise. So I want you to keep this cliff in the back of your mind, We're going to shift gears for just a moment to talk about how health disparities arise, and then we'll come back to the cliff. So how do health disparities arise? Well, especially when you're talking about racial ethnic health disparities, we unfortunately have lots of evidence about differences in the quality of care received within the healthcare system. And when the Institute of Medicine in 2002 released its unequal treatment report, it was a revelation to many. But that report pulled together what were hundreds of studies at that time. Now, if we did the same review, it would be thousands of studies documenting differences within the same healthcare system, everybody in the VA, everybody covered by Medicare and Medicaid, differences in the quality of care received by race or by ethnicity. So, for example, everybody looking at all heart patients in the VA, the vigorousness with which your cardiac symptoms would be addressed differed by race. If you were looking at people walking into emergency departments with a long bone fracture, the amount of pain medication that people received differed by ethnicity, and so forth and so on. But that IOM panel said, we know that this is a revelation, but this is not the only level at which health disparities arise, because some people have trouble getting into the healthcare system in the first place. So that's the second level, differences in access to care. But then I would hope that all of us in this room recognize that health is not really created within the health sector, so that there's a huge third level at which health disparities arise, which are the differences in the conditions of our lives, the differences in our life exposures, opportunities, stresses, resources, and risks that are making some individuals and communities sicker than others in the first place. And when you think about these three levels at which health disparities arise, differences in quality of care, differences in access to care, and differences in underlying exposures and opportunities, you could depict it as a pyramid, or better yet, as an iceberg, where the huge hidden base is the differences in the quality of our lives. And then it is usually those people who've been made sicker who are frustrated because of limited access to the healthcare system. And then even the lucky ones who get into the system are sometimes further injured because of differences in quality of care. So now we're going to go back to the cliff. But now we're going to recognize we're not really dealing with a flat two-dimensional cliff, but actually we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff. And at some parts of the cliff, there's an ambulance there, but that ambulance has a flat tire. So it's slow or goes off in the wrong direction. Or maybe there's no ambulance there at all. And maybe there's no net nor fence. And usually at those parts of the cliff, the population is being pushed closer to the edge. So now I'm going to label the observations about the three-dimensional cliff with how health disparities arise, where the differences in quality of care, that's when the ambulance is there, but it's slower, goes off in the wrong direction. Differences in access to care are no ambulance, no net, no fence, and differences in underlying exposures and opportunities are represented by the closer proximity of that greeny population to the edge. So now that we recognize that we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff, there's a whole new set of questions that arise. First of all, how did the cliff become three-dimensional in the first place? And that's usually because of historical injustices that are being perpetuated by present-day contemporary structural factors. But given that we have a three-dimensional cliff, we also need to ask, why are there differences in how the resources are distributed along that cliff face, and why are there differences in who's found at different parts of the cliff? And when you start asking and addressing these kinds of questions, you're actually doing something that differs from addressing the social determinants of health, which was about moving the population away from the edge of the cliff. You're now doing what I describe as addressing the social determinants of equity, which are systems of power that can distribute resources and populations. And so these social determinants of equity include racism, sexism, heterosexism, economic systems like capitalism and the like. And actually, with this cliff, I have distilled three different dimensions of health intervention. And if you go back to your junior high or high school geometry, you know, one dimension is a line, two dimensions is a flat plane, three dimensions is space. Well, along that line at the edge of the cliff is where we can display all of our curative and preventive health services. The ambulance, net, and fence right there at the edge of the cliff along that line. And, you know, I was talking earlier about using this. If you were thinking about, you know, infant mortality as the outcome, you know, that ambulance, the neonatal intensive care units, the net, prenatal care, the fence, maybe our women, infants, and children programs, it's right there Okay. If you say the word health anywhere in this country, people will complete the thought for you and immediately go to healthcare or health services. Right? Our whole conversation on the Affordable Care Act has been right there. And it's an important conversation. I know that most of us in this room would endorse not just what we have, but going beyond what we have right now and achieving universal access to high-quality health care. Am I right? Right. But the caution there is that that in and of itself is not going to result in large and sustained improvements in health outcomes and the elimination of health disparities. The reason that we need universal access to high-quality health care is because that is how a civilized society values all of its people equally. Right? But as great as the health care is, if everybody's pushed up against that fence, we can overwhelm it. So we have to move into that second dimension, which we can display in a flat plane. We have to be about moving the population away from the edge of the cliff, addressing poverty and adverse neighborhood conditions and the like, if we're going to have large and sustained improvements in health outcomes. But the caution there is, if we start addressing the social determinants of health, moving the population away from the edge of the cliff without recognizing that we're really dealing with a three-dimensional cliff, we are at risk of moving some of the population and not all of the population and actually making health disparities worse. So we must acknowledge and address the three-dimensionality of the cliff, addressing the social determinants of equity, including racism, sexism, heterosexism, capitalism, these other systems of power, if we want to achieve social justice and eliminate health disparities. Now, often I just stop there and I move on. Sometimes I use this story to say the word racism two or three times. And then I joke, and I said it two or three times. Nobody fell off their chair, so let's go, right? But I also want to point out that in this room of family physicians, if I were in a room of cardiologists, then everybody I would know would be like right there in that ambulance, trying to be the best ambulance driver that they could be. But in this room, we have people who are working at many, many levels of this cliff, right? In your practice, in your clinical practice, and in your teaching. I acknowledge that, but wherever you are focusing your effort, it's important for us to recognize that all of it's important. And that even if you are trying to be the best ambulance driver you can be as your day job, as a citizen, you can be addressing all of these other levels. And so that's the challenge and the opportunity that we really need to present to our students. And we need to say that as important as it is to do neighborhood screening or to be community organizing, I was attracted to the residency program in social medicine at Montefiore Hospital after graduating from Stanford University. Actually, when I graduated from Stanford, there was not a clinical residency that I could identify. I didn't even apply in the match, right? There was nothing that was clear to me, so I applied to do public health, as you heard, at Johns Hopkins. And then while there, I discovered RPSM, the residency program in social medicine, what was my kind of doctor who recognized that tenant organizing was just as legitimate a medical intervention as writing a prescription or talking to a patient. And so I know that there's some of us doing all of this, but wherever you're focusing your clinical work, in your professional work, we all need to be about addressing, acknowledging and addressing the three-dimensionality of the cliff, especially because that's the big blind spot in our nation even today. But now I'm going to turn. So that story was for people who might challenge you and say, well, why are you saying racism? Aren't you a doctor? Right? I get that on the airplane a lot, right? So that's the story. That's the story to say why all of us need to be addressing racism. But now I'm going to turn to a very specific focus on racism for much of the rest of my comments. So when I say the word racism, I'm clear that I'm talking about a system. I am not talking about an individual character flaw or a personal moral failing or even a psychiatric illness, as some people have suggested, but I'm talking about a system of power. And a system of doing what? It's a system of structuring opportunity and of assigning value. And on what basis is the opportunity structured? And on what basis is the value assigned? It's based on the social interpretation of how we look, which is what we call race in this country. Now, that might be surprising to some that I'm saying race is the social interpretation of how we look. Because many people who grew up in this country think that race is just like self-evident. You can look at somebody, you know, and you know their race. But if you are not from this country, if you didn't grow up here, you know that when you came here, you had to learn how to make those racial distinctions. And if you've traveled outside of this country, no matter who you are or what you look like, you may have gone to a setting in which your race was not what you thought it was. You're in that different setting, right? For example, I am in Atlanta, Georgia now, where I'm clearly black. In some parts of Brazil, I am just as clearly white. In South Africa, I'm clearly colored. Same physical appearance, but the social interpretation of my physical appearance in those three settings assigns me to three different racial groups. And furthermore, if I were to stay in any of those settings long enough, my health outcome would probably take on that of the group to which I've been assigned, even though I'd have the same genes in all three places. So anyway, so I'm conceptualizing and understanding race as the social interpretation of how we look in a race-conscious society, and racism as the system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on that so-called race. Now, what are the impacts of racism? Well, when we think or talk about racism at all in this country, which is not frequently enough, and it's almost sporadic. Oops, something happened again. You know, it raised its ugly head type of thing, you know. But when we do, we understand that it unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities. But it doesn't take very long to recognize that every unfair disadvantage has its reciprocal unfair advantage, so that racism is also unfairly advantaging other individuals and communities. And that's the whole issue of unearned white privilege that we hardly ever talk about in this country. And it makes people uncomfortable just to hear the words. And I know that some of you in this room are uncomfortable and you're trying to bring yourselves back. So, you know, come back, because I mean, I know that it's hard. And I'm actually going to present an allegory at the end of this talk which will enable even that conversation to be had. But even as we recognize, okay, we have a system that's either unfairly disadvantaging or unfairly advantaging individuals and communities, racism is also sapping the strength of our whole society through the waste of human resources. I am glad for that applause. We could all give many, many examples of that. I'm going to just lift up two kinds of categories of examples. The first is how we as a nation are not yet vigorously investing in the full, excellent public education of all of our children, right? These blinders of racism that don't value all of us equally are making us believe, some of us, that there's no genius in the barrios or the ghettos or on the reservations. We can get along very well, thank you, without those kids. But of course, we know that there is genius in all of our communities. And if we were to fully invest in that genius, we could be doing so much better as a nation or even as a world. And I used to just say, we'd already be up on Mars farming if that were a good idea, right? But we wouldn't even have to go that far. We would already be solving the problems in our communities if we were to invest in all of that genius. Another example of how racism saps the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources is how these same blinders have made us complacent with what I describe as a wholesale warehousing disproportionately of so many black and brown men in our prison system, as if that did not separate us from human potential. And our keynote speaker tomorrow is going to be addressing that issue head on, right? So, but if you know any of the folks who are either stuck in the prison or cycling in and out, come out, can't vote in many states, can't get public housing, can't get a job, and no other options, you know that there are many geniuses stuck in that system that if there had only been some other way, would be contributing quite productively to our society. And so actually, when I look at those three bullets of how racism, you know, the impacts of racism, like what is it doing to us, it's very important to acknowledge and call out, document the unfair disadvantage and its reciprocal unfair advantage. But I actually think that third bullet about how racism saps the strength of the whole society is very poorly understood. And so I would like us to lift that up. I would like us to lift that up in our media stories, in our research, in your teaching, and challenge students to try to lift that up. In my storytelling, I'm trying to find that perfect story to talk about that. And in that way, if we have more media stories, data collections, even conversations around our dinner tables, we will engage more people with a sense of urgency in terms of dismantling this system and putting in its place a system in which all people can know and develop to their full potentials. But now, how could racism impact health? Well, I have found it useful to talk about these three levels of racism if I want to answer the question, how could racism turn into increased asthma prevalence in one community versus another, or increased obesity prevalence, or, you know, cancer mortality, et cetera, et cetera. And so these three levels, institutionalized, personally mediated, and internalized, I'm going to define for you, provide examples of each of these levels, and then I'll illustrate them with my gardener's tale allegory. So the first level of racism, institutionalized, is that constellation, if you will, of structures, policies, practices, norms, and values, the system, if you will, that results in differential access to the goods, services, and opportunities of society by race. This is the kind of racism that does not require an identifiable perpetrator, and in fact often shows up as inherited disadvantage or its reciprocal inherited advantage. This is the kind of racism that's been institutionalized in our laws and our customs and background norms, and it often shows up as differences in material conditions or access to power. So here are some concrete examples. Differences by race in terms of quality housing or excellent educational opportunities or equal employment opportunities or even the same level of income at the same level of employment. And clearly these things can impact health. Differential access to medical facilities, including linguistic access. Differential access to a clean environment. I used to talk about the differential placement of toxic dump sites in communities of color, bus transfer stations. Now I can just talk about Flint, Michigan. Oh, my God, right? And would that have happened in some of these other places? In fact, would the four cities in Michigan that have 50% of African Americans of the whole state, would they be the ones under emergency management, which strips them of their democracy, right, where there are other cities in Michigan that also have financial issues but are not under emergency. So anyway, you could just go there. But anyway, so sorry. Sorry, I jumped off. But that's because I visited Flint. And I have to tell you, I don't know if there are any Flint residents in here right now. I mean, any people from Flint. It is rough. I was just there for 2 days. And I'm thinking, am I really going to work out today? Because do I want to take a shower? Imagine you're trying to bathe your little girls in that water and worried about what's absorbed through their skin. Anyway, so clean environments. I really got off there. But but these are important issues. The reason I have to talk about Flint is because if we don't keep talking about it, things have not changed here. They switched the Flint water supply back to Lake Huron, the water Detroit, but they have not replaced those pipes. The water that's coming through, the corrosion has caused, it's almost like toxic waste coming through the water in terms of the lead levels now, and yet the national attention has flagged. And so, anyway, getting back to racism and how it can institutionalize racism, we also see that through access to power. So that power could be information, health information, information about our own histories, information about the conditions of your water. It could be resources, not just capital resources, but social networking resources. It could be voice in government and media and the like. And before I go on with this slide, sometimes people have asked me to take a close look at the top bullet of examples, housing, education, employment, and income, because they said, Dr. Jones, when you really look at that, isn't that what we call social class? Why do you have that on your slide about racism? Are you talking about racism? Are you really, really, really talking about social class? And that's an important question. Many of you are nodding your heads. You're like, okay, so what are you going to say about that? Well, my answer starts with the observation that it doesn't just so happen that people of color in this country are overrepresented in poverty, while white people in this country are overrepresented in wealth. That is not just a happenstance. And for each marginalized or oppressed or stigmatized group of color, there has been some initial historical insult. So for American Indians, it started with the taking of the land and the near genocide and then the moving of the survivors to reserve lands, reservations. And then in some instances, something good was found under one reservation. Oops, you got to pick them up and move them somewhere else. You know, we have people who for centuries have been living in Mexico, when parts of Mexico became New Mexico, you know, Texas, California, they didn't move across the border. Border moved across them, and yet their children and progeny are still being harassed today. We could talk about the Chinese laborers who came to build our railroads, unable to bring their families and unable to marry here, Japanese internment camps during World War II. We could talk about the kidnapping of West African people and our importation across the Atlantic with tremendous loss of life in the Middle Passage, and then what I describe as the coerced usury of our unpaid labor for centuries to build this country. But then people, yeah? And then some people say, well, Dr. Jones, there you go, talking about slavery. And we recognize they'll say that slavery was an... My mic is going in and out. Is it because I've done something? Okay. I am going to go there, right? So, you know, they'll say, you know, slavery's an unfortunate chapter in our nation's history, but Dr. Jones, the enslaved people were emancipated in 1865, and we're in 2016, so that means we're 151 years beyond that. So all else being equal, they'll ask me, Dr. Jones, all else being equal, don't you think the impacts of slavery would have washed out by now? But the key phrase, all else being equal. And all else has not been equal since 1865, and all else still is not equal today. And there are still contemporary structural factors that are perpetuating each of these initial historical injustices. And those contemporary structural factors are part and parcel of institutionalized racism. So when you ask me, am I talking about racism or am I talking about social class? I say that institutionalized racism explains why we even see an association between social class and race in this country. And that's a hugely important aha. Because what it means, I acknowledge it is important for us to eliminate poverty across this nation. I would go further. I would eliminate income inequality. I'd flatten the whole thing out. My husband and I actually disagree on that, but I would, right? But even if I had a magic wand to do that today, if I had such a magic wand, I would do it right now. So here we go. Ding, 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 done, right? But if I had that magic wand and did it today, but did not address the background structures, policies, practices, norms, and values, the background mechanisms of institutionalized racism that were put in place to differentially shunt different populations to different possibilities, if I equalize things today, within 20 years, within one generation, we would start to see a stratification by race again in terms of income. It's an important realization. The other thing before I leave institutionalized racism is that it can be through acts of doing, acts of commission, as well as acts of not doing, acts of omission. And very often, institutionalized racism shows up as inaction in the face of need. The second level of racism, personally mediated racism, I define as differential assumptions about the abilities, motives, and intents of others by race, and then differential actions based on those assumptions. So this is what most people think of when they hear the word racism. Somebody did something to somebody. It includes the different idea, the prejudice, and the different action, the discrimination. And how could this impact your health? Well, police brutality. I used to talk about being pulled over for driving while black or driving while Latino and then interpreted as resisting arrest and hit upside the head. Now we in this room could just lift a litany of names, right? Mike Brown, Eric Garner, Walter Scott, Laquan McDonald, Sandra Bland, little baby Tamir Rice, on and on and on. Trayvon Martin wasn't even a police officer. It was a self-appointed neighborhood watchman who thought that that young man did not look like he belonged in that neighborhood and hunted him down and killed him. And on and on. And it's not because these acts of police brutality without accountability, it's not like they are new. It's because now we have cell phones and dash cams and the like. But these things clearly impact not just the health of those who've been killed and their families, but it impacts the health of whole communities because to the extent that there is no accountability, folks are just bracing themselves for the next occurrence. Physician disrespect, which could be as subtle as a physician not giving a patient the full range of treatment options because the physician figures that patient wouldn't understand or couldn't afford or wouldn't comply or whatever the assumption is. Or it could be quite blatant, like sterilization abuse, which has had many iterations in our nation's history. Shopkeeper vigilance, being followed around in stores, or waiter indifference, not getting quick, respectful treatment. These are just two examples of what some people call everyday racism, the kind of microaggressions, the subtle communication of disrespect that might actually be related to elevated blood pressures in communities of color. You know, blood pressures that don't even go down at night. Teacher devaluation, that's a hugely important manifestation of personally mediated racism, because if a teacher looks at a young child and thinks, that child can't learn, and puts them off in the ADD track, that child will never even know their full potential, much less have the opportunity to develop to their full potential. Now, like institutionalized racism, personally mediated racism can be through acts of doing, acts of commission, as well as acts of not doing, acts of omission. But more important, perhaps, to understand with this level is that it can be unintentional as well as intentional. You do not have to have intended to do something racist to have had a racist impact. The third level of racism, internalized racism, I define from the point of view of members of the stigmatized races as acceptance by members of the stigmatized races of negative messages about our own abilities and intrinsic worth. And actually, I have friends who do anti-racism training who have challenged me and said, but your definition of internalized racism is incomplete, because isn't that internalized sense of entitlement that many white people walk around with, isn't that also internalized racism? And yes, it is. I don't have a complete treatment of that right now. I'm going to put it over in background, institutionalized, normative stuff. So today I'm speaking from the point of view of members of the stigmatized races, where examples of the detrimental impacts include self-devaluation, feeling maybe I'm really not as good as, maybe I shouldn't try to graduate from high school, or apply to that college, or for that job, or try to live in that neighborhood. And in fact, this self-devaluation actually turns into fratricide, black on black, Latino on Latino crime, because if you don't value yourself, you won't value others who look very much like you, and you would just as soon off them as not. The white man's ice is colder syndrome. That phraseology comes from my parents' generation. And what it meant then, it still means today for many people of color. Say you're black and you need a lawyer, you might go look for a white lawyer. Or if you needed a doctor, you might go seek out a white doctor. In fact, if your lemonade were warm, you might go way down the street to get the white man's ice over the black man's ice, deeply believing that the white man's ice is colder, deeply internalizing the myth of white superiority. Resignation, helplessness, hopelessness turns into a lot of self-destructive health behaviors, turns into not registering to vote, turns into not voting even if you are registered, which also has health impacts. And really, internalized racism is about members of stigmatized races accepting the limitations to their own full humanity of the box into which we've been placed. So that when you hear young students, high school students of color, one of them's trying to be the valedictorian, and the others are saying, well, you know, so-and-so is just trying to be white, and they're teasing them, we have to challenge that. Because since when did white people claim exclusive access to excellence? They did not. So now I'm going to illustrate these three levels of racism with my gardener's tale allegory. And I'm actually, how many of you are familiar with the gardener's tale? So I think that's about a fourth of you. So I'm going to tell it, but challenge those of you who use it, teach it, have heard it before, to listen in a very intent way so that you can tell it back even better, okay? And I'm going to step from behind this because I have my mic with me. And let you know that, first of all, this gardener's tale is one of many allegories now that I've developed based on things I've seen with my own real eyes. So let me just describe what I saw with my own real eyes, and then we're going to make it a story about racism. Okay. So my husband and I, you know, newly married, moving back to Baltimore from New York, right, finished residency and all that, and bought our first freestanding house. Cute little house with a big wraparound porch, with flower boxes dotted all along the porch, and we closed on the house in October, so we weren't even thinking about those flower boxes until spring. But when spring came, we were all excited we were going to decorate our house. So we run out with our marigold seeds, getting ready to plant, and we saw that some of the boxes had dirt in them, but some of the boxes were empty. So my husband dutifully goes down to the gardening store. He's hauling big old bags of potting soil back, and we fill up the empty boxes, and then we take equal numbers of our marigold seeds, and we put them in all of the flower boxes, and we water all of the boxes. And, you know, I'm not the gardener in the family, so by that time I'm exhausted, so I just sit back, right, just going to enjoy. But 3 weeks later, when I'm walking out of my front door, onto my porch, I stopped in my tracks looking at those flower boxes because it looked to me like we had planted completely different species in some boxes versus the others. Some of the boxes were full of plants, and they were tall, vigorous-looking plants, and some of the boxes just had a few plants in them, and they were scrawny and scraggly-looking. And then I realized what had happened. That potting soil that my husband had bought turned out to be rich, fertile soil, so that every single seed planted in the rich, fertile soil had sprouted, with the strong seed growing very tall and vigorous, and even the weak seed making it halfway up. But that old soil that we had found in the flower boxes turned out to be poor, rocky soil. So the weak seed planted in that poor, rocky soil had just died, and even the strong seed in the poor, rocky soil had to struggle to make it to a middling height. And some of you guys are nodding, so I know there's some gardeners in this room, right? And you're nodding because maybe you've composted half of your garden. So maybe you've seen this with your own real eyes. And the image is about the importance of the soil, the importance of the environment. But now I'm going to take this image and I'm going to make it a story about racism by introducing a gardener. So now we're going to have a gardener who has two flower boxes, one which she knows to have rich, fertile soil, one which she knows to have poor, rocky soil. And she has seed for the same kind of flowers, except some of the seed is going to produce pink blossoms, and some of the seed is going to produce red blossoms, and the gardener prefers red over pink. So what does she do? She takes the red seed and she puts it in the rich, fertile soil, and the pink seed she throws over in the poor, rocky soil. And 3 weeks later, in her garden, she sees what I saw in mine. In the rich, fertile soil, all the red seed is sprouted, strong red seed, tall and vigorous, weak red seed at least makes it halfway up. Poor rocky soil, the weak pink seed has died, and here comes a strong pink seed struggling to make it to a middling height. And then in those two flower boxes, those flowers go to seed. And the next year, the same thing happens. And then those flowers go to seed. And year after year after year after year, the same thing happens until finally, about 10 years later, the gardener is looking at her flower boxes and she says, "You know, I was right to prefer red over pink." So we're going to interrupt the story for a moment there to say the first part of this story is how institutionalized racism works, where you had the initial historical insult of the separation of the seed into the two types of soil, yet the contemporary structural factors of the flower boxes keeping the soil separate, and then through inaction in the face of need, perpetuation of the inequity. But let's pick the story back up to say, well, where's personally mediated racism in this garden? Well, the gardener is looking at the red flowers and thinks, "Oh, those flowers sure are beautiful." And then she looks over at the pink flowers and she says, "Oh, those flowers sure are scrawny and scraggly." So she plucks off the pink blossoms before they can even go to seed. Or maybe she notices that a pink seed has blown into the rich, fertile soil. So she plucks it out before it can establish itself, which is some of the anti-affirmative action stuff that goes on. And where would internalized racism be in the garden? Well, the red flowers are just living their lives, enjoying being red, many of them not even understanding or acknowledging that they're benefiting from enriched soil. The pink flowers are looking over at red, thinking red is mighty fine, and wishing with all of their hearts that they too could be red. And here come the bees. And the bees are just minding their own business, collecting nectar, but pollinating at the same time. So here comes a bee, bzzz, into one of the pink flowers, and then bzzz, to another pink flower, and then bzzz, to this pink flower, and this flower's like, "Get away from me, bee. Don't bring me any of that pink pollen. I prefer the red," because the pink flower has internalized that red is better than pink. So now what do we do to set things right in this garden? Well, we could start by addressing the internalized racism. So we can go over to the pink flowers and we can say, "Pink is beautiful. Power to the pink." And that is an important intervention. That is an important intervention. But if that's all that we do, it's not going to change the situation in which the pink flowers find themselves. So you might say, "Oh, okay, well, let's address the personally mediated racism. Let's have a conversation with the gardener. Or better yet, let's have a workplace multicultural workshop for the gardener." That's also great. It's great. It's all good. So we have our workshop, right? And in the workshop, we say, "Dear gardener, would you please stop plucking those pink flowers?" And maybe she will and maybe she won't. But even if she stops plucking the pink flowers, it's still not going to change the situation in which they find themselves. I think that if we really want to set things right in this garden, we need to address the institutionalized racism, which means that we have to either break down the boxes and mix up the soil, or if you want to keep the boxes separate, that's all right too, although in my mind it makes it easier for the gardener to continue segregating resources going forward. But if you keep separate boxes, it means you need to enrich that poor rocky soil until it is as rich as the rich fertile soil. And when you do that, the pink flowers will flourish. They'll be looking beautiful, grand, and glorious. And then, in that intervention, you may also address the internalized racism, right? Because pink will no longer be looking over at red, thinking red is better, or wanting to be red. And in the intervention on the institutionalized racism, you may also address the personally mediated racism. Now, the original gardener may have to go to her grave preferring red over pink. But her children who grow up and see the flowers equally beautiful will be less likely to have that kind of attitude. So this story has been to illustrate these three levels of racism, institutionalized, personally mediated, and internalized, and to strongly suggest that if we want to set things right in the garden, we need to at least address the institutionalized racism. Good to address all the levels at the same time, but at least address the institutionalized, and when we do, the other levels may take care of themselves. But there's one more question before I leave this story that I haven't raised yet, and that is, who is the gardener? After all, the gardener is the one that I gave the power to decide, the power to act, and control of resources, which in my mind are actually the elements of self-determination. Well, who is the gardener? Government is a huge part of the gardener. In fact, my slide used to read, who is the gardener? Government. Power to decide, power to act, control of resources. Until, as you heard, I used to work at CDC. When I went to CDC, I modified my slide. But that's true. Yes. Yeah, clearance, right. But anyway, but government's not the only part of the gardener. So foundations, corporations, media, communities, to the extent that they have self-determination, are all part of the gardener. But whoever the gardener is, it is dangerous when the gardener is allied with one group. I painted her red. That's why she prefers red over pink. And it's also dangerous when she's not concerned with equity, when she can look at her flower boxes and think that her garden is beautiful, thank you, because she's not even counting the pink flowers as part of her garden. And so our challenge is what to do about the gardener. Do we make the gardener striped or polka dotted or fuchsia? Do the pink flowers have to grow or recruit their own gardener? Lots of questions that can come out of it. And I don't want to belabor this story now. I do hope we'll still have time for conversation about it, but I do want to just lift up two things that have come up in past tellings of this story. The first was the question, Dr. Jones, excuse me, but why should the red flowers share their soil? I thought, whoa, that's a good question, you know? And first of all, it shows the power of this story to start conversations about racism. Because if we were talking about racism between you and me, that question would never come up. Right? But my answer to why should the red flowers share their soil is that actually that soil doesn't belong to the red flowers, it belongs to the garden, right? But what if that's not the original gardener that we're looking at? It's the second question. What if that's the gardener's great-great-great-great-grandchild? Here we are. And that great-great-great-great-grandchild has always seen the flowers looking like this. What then? Because there may not even be a problem perceived there. I think that that's the current state of affairs. So there are three important points that I want to quickly lift up there. The first is that we must make the differences in the height and vigor of the pink and red flowers an urgent problem to solve. Right? And so the 16th Surgeon General, Dr. David Satcher, and President Clinton at the time in 1998, they announced an initiative to eliminate racial ethnic health disparities by the year 2010. That was the first time that our nation's health plan was not saying if this is black infant mortality and white infant mortality, the goal is this. It was the first time that the goal was this, to eliminate that gap. So that was an important thing. But then many of us recognize we are now 6 years past 2010 and that we did not eliminate racial ethnic health disparities. So that points out the difficulty in doing that, and what we have to do is stop pruning, you know, this weed and get to the root. And so the second thing I want to lift up is that we must make those flower boxes transparent. I mean, we're trying to dismantle them. But in the meantime, we have to at least make them transparent. We need to be talking about the differences in the quality of the soil, because that is not evident to people. And as we do that, we also, the third point is that we need to make it clear that the pink seed did not just go jump into that poor rocky soil. So we need to talk about history. We need to talk about the gardener's agency in all of this and the gardener's responsibility actually to rectify situations. But now I'm going to Well, let me just say this. The Gardener's Tale, I've been telling that for a long time. And it used to just be about the differences in the quality of the soil until I recognized that the gardener's initial preference for red over pink set up the whole situation. And even if we were able to compel the gardener to equalize the soil today, if the gardener continued to prefer red over pink going forward, then the gardener would continue to privilege red over pink going forward. And so we not only need to deal with the opportunity structures, but also the societal valuation. You know, some people call that gardener's initial preference for red over pink cultural racism or white supremacist ideology or whatever. I mean, we are dealing with this now. I mean, there in our politics today, there are people who want to make America white again. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Make America, you know the slogan. Right? So we must address that head on. I never used to think about values. I used to be all about structures and stuff. The values piece is important too. So then I want to say that I encourage all of us to take the question, how is racism operating here to our work settings, to our community settings, our children's school, et cetera, because racism is not a miasma or a cloud that you can't get a handle on. It's a system with identifiable and addressable mechanisms which are in our structures, policies, practices, norms, and values, where the structures are the who, what, when, and where of decision-making. These are all elements of decision-making. Structures are who's at the table, who's not, what's on the agenda, and what's not. And whenever we're at a decision-making table, we should look around and say, who is not at this table, who has an interest in this proceeding, and then not just represent their interests, but try to find them a way to the table. Policies are the written how of decision-making, practices and norms are the unwritten how, and values are the why. And we need to interrogate all of these as we're trying to figure out where to intervene. How is racism operating here? The definition I gave you of racism can be generalized to be a definition of any system of structured inequity. So you could say, what is sexism? That's a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on gender that unfairly disadvantages some, unfairly advantages others, and saps the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. And there are many axes of inequity operating in our society today, intersecting in communities and in individuals. Here is a partial list. And all of these are at least operating as risk markers for how opportunity is structured and value is assigned, even as a very few of them are also in the pathway as risk factors toward disease. So now you say, well, Dr. Jones, you just spent all that time on racism, but now you're saying, yeah, I recognize this other stuff is going on too. Why should we be concerned about race as the axis of inequity and racism as a system if all this other stuff is going on? And I tell you, it is because racism is foundational in our nation's history, and yet many people are in denial of its continued existence today and its continued profound impacts on the health and well-being of the nation. So we need to talk about race and racism, even as we recognize all these others. And, you know, as our efforts to dismantle racism will, as we join in collaboration and partnership and coalition with others, will help. All of these struggles will help one another. But we must start with this foundational, the original sin, if you will, of this nation. So now I'm going to very quickly race through a few other tools, conceptual tools, and end with three allegories. Do I have time? How much more time do I have, actually? 2 minutes. Okay, so I'm going to be going over time. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I got 10 more minutes. 10 more minutes, okay. If you thought that I was talking fast, here I go. Okay, so here's my definition of health equity, three parts. What is it, how do we get there, and how is it related to health disparities? This is not the Healthy People 2020 definition. I contributed to that definition, but it differs because I can continue thinking, and that one got stuck, in clearance and all. So I define health equity as assurance of the conditions for optimal health for all people. Healthy People 2020 defines health equity as attainment of the highest level of health for all people, and I agree that that is our goal. But what troubles me about that definition is, what if we hit that last Sunday? Are we done? In my mind, health equity is not an outcome, it's a process. Which process? Assurance, which is actually one of the three core functions of public health, along with assessment and policy development. Assurance of what? Of the conditions for optimal health, the social determinants of health, if you will. For whom? For all people. That makes it equity. How do we get there? Achieving health equity requires at least these three things: valuing all individuals and populations equally, recognizing and rectifying historical injustices, and providing resources according to need. And how is it related to health disparities? Health disparities will be eliminated when health equity is achieved. Health disparities is counting the different numbers of different colored bodies at the bottom of the cliff, or counting the differences in the height and vigor of the pink and red flowers. Health equity is all that stuff that came before. Okay. So, who in this room has ever heard of ICERD, the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination? Raise your hand. And actually, Dr. Southpaw, you slightly misrepresented me in relation to this, so I'm going to clarify it right now. So, what is ICERD? It is an international anti-racism treaty that was adopted by the UN General Assembly way back in 1965. Who even knew that there was an international anti-racism treaty? We didn't, right? Like, nobody in this room. Do you think the U.S. signed this treaty? Surprise! Yes! Yes! In 1966. But the trick there, of course, if you know anything about international stuff, is that our diplomats can sign any treaty they want, but the Senate has to ratify the treaty before it has any impact on us. Aha! Okay, so here's a question. You think the U.S. Senate ratified this treaty? It's a trick question. Yes. 28 years later, but in 1994, the Senate ratified the treaty. What does that mean? It means that today, we have international obligations to do right under this 9-page treaty. One of the obligations is to submit periodic reports, which we do. Our State Department submits nice, big, long reports every 6 years to a UN committee. And that committee gets not only the State Department report, they get a report from anybody else who wants to send them something. STFM could submit a parallel report for the next cycle, right? Right? And then this UN committee considers everything. Our last one was considered in August of 2014, and then they send back to each country, after they consider all their stuff, what they call their concluding observations. So we got our most recent concluding observations in September 2014. It's only 14 pages. I hope that all of us in this room will read it sometime this week. And it starts out, "Dear United States, thank you for your report. We remain concerned about racial profiling, residential segregation, the achievement gap in education, differential access to healthcare, disproportionate incarceration, and on and on and on." And not only do they remain concerned, there are specific recommendations to address each of these concerns. And there are other recommendations too, including, "We think you need to adopt a national action plan to combat structural racial discrimination." This was the first concluding observations that called specifically for a national action plan. So I think our American Public Health Association, let's think of that as a public-private partnership. I mean, I think that what we're doing is trying to help in that effort. They also said, "Dear United States, you need to let your people know about the existence of this treaty." So now every time I talk, I do my part, right? So I'm going to close with three very quick allegories on different aspects of race and racism. The first one, Japanese lanterns, colored perceptions, was sparked by my experience as a Stanford medical student, if you will. I was invited by a faculty member to a garden party, and the garden was festooned with beautiful, you know, Japanese lanterns and colored light bulbs, and, you know, evening was falling, and I was chitting and chatting and noshing and all that, and I got a little tired, so I decided I'm going to go sit on the edge of the garden and let the conversation and the music just wash over me. So I'm going to be looking this way. So as I sat there, I became fascinated by, As I sat there, I became fascinated by a group of pink moths. And I was just like in a zen kind of, you know, this was just lovely. And then something caused my gaze to shift. And I was like, "Oh, look at the green moths over there and the blue moths over there. And isn't it interesting how they're sorting according to their kind?" For just a minute, I thought that. And you guys are laughing at me now, right? Because you realize I could have been in another part of the garden and I could have been talking about yellow or purple or orange moths, right? And you've seen moths you know, the little insects, right? And you've seen them under a universal light, so you know they don't come in pink and purple and blue and yellow and green and orange. They are different colors, yes, but they're different colors of tan and brown and speckled and splotched. And then I understood that the colors that I thought I saw and the colors that we think we see so naturally are due to the lights by which we look, where the colored lights are distorting and masking our own true variability. And it started me thinking about what is race and how do the racial categories that we construct color our vision of who we are. And it was just a nice little illustration about race as a social classification, not a biologic descriptor. Race as the social interpretation of how we look in a race-conscious society. And if we're in a society that's going to put up black and white and Latino and other lights, that's what we're going to see. Go to a different part of the world, you're going to put different lights. That's what you're going to see. And only when we see each other under universal light will we understand our true variability. We are different, but it's not in the ways that we presume and think. And in fact, the lights that we have in this country are even more dangerous, first of all, because we have nets around those lights, right, that keep the malls. And we value some of those lights more than others. And the malls around those lights start to really think that they are pink or blue or purple, right? All of us. The second story, also sparked by an experience I had as a Stanford medical student, fertile time in my life, was sparked by my experience studying late in the apartment with some friends. We got hungry, no food in the apartment. We decide we need to go get something to eat. So we go into town and we're looking for some food. We find a restaurant, we walk in, we sit down, restaurant presents the menus, we order our food, food is served, here we are eating. Okay, so it's not a very exciting story yet. Many of you have had that experience. But as I sat at that table eating with my friends, I looked across the room and I noticed a sign, and the sign said open, and it was a revelation to me about racism. Now, let me paint the picture. Here I am sitting at the table of opportunity, eating. And I look up and I see a sign that says open. And if I hadn't known something about the two-sided nature of those signs, and that in fact that now the restaurant was closed, I would have presumed that any other hungry people could just feet away from me, could walk in, sit down, order their food and eat. But in fact, they could not. And then I understood that racism structures open, closed signs in our society. That racism creates a dual reality. Right? That for those who are inside, sitting at the table of opportunity, eating, they don't even know there's a two-sided sign going on when they see that open sign, because it is difficult for any of us to recognize a system of inequity that privileges us. It is difficult for men to recognize male privilege and sexism. It is difficult for white Americans to recognize white privilege and racism. It is difficult for all Americans to recognize our American privilege in the global context, except we got a little hint of that, didn't we, with Ebola. Yet for those on the outside, they're very well aware there's a two-sided sign going on because it proclaims closed to them, and yet they can look through the window and see people inside eating. And so back inside, for those who would say, is there really a two-sided sign? Does racism really exist? I acknowledge it's hard to know when you only see open. In fact, that's part of your privilege, not to have to know. But once you do know, you can choose to act. So it's not a scary thing to name racism. It is an empowering thing. It doesn't compel you to act, but it equips you to act. And if you care about those people on the other side of the sign, you could even talk to the restaurant owner and say, why don't you reopen the restaurant? You know, you'll make more money. There are hungry people outside. They'll make more money. And oh, the conversations we can have. Or maybe you'll pass food through the door or break down the glass or tear down the sign or whatever, but you won't be sitting there saying, huh, wonder why those people don't just walk on in and sit down and eat, because you'll understand something about the two-sided nature of the sign. And this image actually is quite useful for people who don't understand white privilege. Okay, so, you know, I promised you an allegory that would help with that. This is the one. The last allegory is actually not sparked by my own real experience. It's sparked by an image from the book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race, by Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum. Can you all see me? I mean, I know this lectern, so everybody, you guys can see, because I'm going to be walking and doing stuff, okay? And I don't want to go too far back. I don't know. Okay, anyway, here we go. Don't let me fall off. I know, it's on me. So anyway, in her book... She has an image, and I'm going to expand on that image to talk about how we become actively racist, anti-racist. Oh, we're already actively racist, isn't it? Now, how we can become actively anti-racist. So in her book, she describes racism as a passive process, basically like a people mover, a conveyor belt, and people are just going to work, living their lives, raising their kids, going to church or whatever, and they're not trying to be racist, but they're constantly moving through racism and toward racism and surrounded by racism and probably benefiting, depending on where you are, if you're under the conveyor belt on top, you're benefiting from racism, not trying to do it. I'm going to take that image of racism as a passive process, life on a conveyor belt, and I'm going to talk about how we become actively anti-racist. So here we are. We're on the conveyor belt, and we're just going to school, going, you know, doing our job or whatever, and, you know, racism is most often passive, and there's a big sign here that says racism if we only looked up, but most people don't even look up. And then some might look up, and they're like, oh, and then they close their eyes because they're in denial, right, and they're going to keep going. Or maybe they look up, and they're like, oh, not me, right? And so then they turn around. So maybe they're colorblind. They're still not doing anything else, still moving in that same direction. But now I'm going to challenge us today. What are we to do on this conveyor belt? So here we are. We're on the conveyor belt, and we look up, and we see racism because we believe that what Kamara said is right, because we remember that open-close sign, okay? So that's why we're all going to see it all of a sudden. What are we supposed to do? Well, the first thing we have to do is to turn around, but now we have to move, right? Because if we didn't move, if we weren't active, we would keep going back. So now what we have to start walking, right? And we have to walk, become actively anti-racist, at least as fast as the conveyor belt is moving. And let me ask you, what happens when you're walking backwards on a crowded conveyor belt? You are going to bump into people, and it's going to be uncomfortable, and they're going to say, hey, buddy, watch out, where are you going? It'll be uncomfortable for them and uncomfortable for you, and this is your opportunity to do the first of three stages of being actively anti-racist, which is to name racism, to say, do you see where we're going? Do you want to go there, or will you turn around with me? Now, most people will just say, oh, get out of my way, because they don't want to be disturbed out of their comfort, but one or two will turn with you. So now you have two or three of you walking backwards on this crowded conveyor belt, and you keep bumping into people, and you keep naming racism, and more will turn. I don't think we should ever think 50%, not even, but more and more will turn. So now that you're building up a critical mass, you actually don't have to just stay in the same place. You can actually move further away from racism, but you're not just trying to get away from that sign. You're trying to actually to get to the motor that is running this conveyor belt. So here we're moving, moving, we're getting more and more, and here's the motor. I see it. And now's the time to do the second of three stages of being actively anti-racist, which is to ask the question, how is racism operating here? Looking at structures, policies, practices, norms, and values. And I think it's this lever. So I'm going to get this lever, and I pull it up, and the whole thing's shaking. I was right. I was right. But you know, racism is a very fancy system. So it reconfigures itself, and it keeps on going. Which points out the importance of the third stage of being actively anti-racist, which is to organize and strategize to act. So as I'm pulling up on this lever, I need you to push a button, right? I need you guys to spin that dial. I need somebody else to pull on the pulley. I need all of us working together to dismantle this system and put in its place a system in which all people can know and develop to their full potentials. And that's why I am taking my life's work with this golden opportunity to launch a national campaign against racism. I invite all of you to name racism, ask how is racism operating here, and then to organize and strategize to act. Go to www.apha.org/racism right now. We just have a page, but in about a month, we're going to be launching an anti-racism collaborative with seven collective action teams to harness the energy, passion, and vision of all of us. So thank you very much, and thank you for letting me have a little bit extra time. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Wow. Thank you. Let's go.
5 minutes. For
right? Let's go. Let's go.
5 minutes for questions. I use this as an opportunity. I know we've all been energized, and I just don't think we can just go and have coffee quite yet. 5 minutes for questions, and okay. You can manage it. Please come to the mic.
Yes, go to the mic. And actually, I would like a piece of paper. I would like to write down all of the questions and so that we could hear all the questions, and then I'll quickly do a blitz answer. So if somebody could give me a pen and a piece of paper so I could write down the questions.
My first one's really easy. And that is, the very last thing you said was one of the most important things you said. It was a call to action, and then you spoke the fastest you did all day, because you say that really slowly so we can all write it down and be engaged.
Okay, so actually, so this is my contact information, but let me, hold on. Oh, I'm going to have to get, I actually have information where you can get it. I just wasn't thinking here. In terms of my order. And then how can I? Can somebody make this? Can you back? Tracy, can you make that big? Anyway. I can only do it here? But anyway.
There you go.
You can see it. Okay, there you go. Okay, so www.apha.org/racism. So that's American Public Health Association. We have an active web page right now. It doesn't have all the resources, but it has some stuff there. In about a month, because we're still putting in place our the co-chairs of 7 collective action teams, you see the areas that they're going to do. I want one for each co-chair pair. I'm going to have an APHA past president and an anti-racism scholar, activist, whatever. So we're putting that in place right now. And then once that goes, then you'll find it there. And that's how you can join.
Thank you so much, Dr. Jones. There's so many concrete things that you said that are very stimulating and empowering. I have something in mind that's maybe a little bit more abstract, but I think is important as well. And that is, in dealing with the healing process of people who are suffering from addictions and other chronic illnesses, shame is a very prominent part of the healing process. In taking that to a larger dimension of society, an individual, especially when talking to white people or people who have that power who haven't been corrupted by that power, how do you see shame in the process of improving our society and our individual lives?
Okay. Next question. I'm going to write my thing. So.
Thank you very much. And I did get 3 points about how I can better utilize the gardener's tale, so thank you so much for that. I do a lot of work in interprofessional education and practice, and I see a parallel between the cultural aspects and structural aspects that separate us from your talk and how we actually look at all the cultures of medicine, nursing, all the different health professions, especially medicine and public health. And there are many people in this room who are actively and so skilled in looking at what you've talked about in the clinical setting and how we care in our communities. How can we utilize the same tools and same approaches to break down our structured ways of looking at interprofessionalism and how we value people equally as they come to the table to change the healthcare system and change the care of our patients?
Thank you.
Veronica Suetas, and I will spend, like, I don't know, 3 hours to thank you for everything that you have said and done. But I want to bring some awareness and to, it's a question, but it's also to initiate a quest of collaboration with APHA. I work a lot at the Society of Adolescent Health and Services, and I was doing a workshop on how to build inclusive programs for adolescent teens. And one of the pieces was like, how do you talk? You need to talk, kind of like ethnic identity. You need to talk about, bring up the conversation about racism, bias, discrimination, and providers started to cry, saying, most of them minorities, saying, how can I do that? When I feel, after all this police encounter, when there was no accountability, going crying to work, and no one seemed to care, like no one seemed shaken and hurt as I was. So I started thinking, I'm the new chair of the diversity committee at SAM, and I wanted to create some sort of like balling group for minority providers to be able to feel, to heal, and to be able to start helping heal others, families, and teens who are living this daily. So my question is, like, how can we partner with APHA to make this happen? Thank you so much for all that you do.
Thank you.
I guess I want to just start by saying that I'm feeling overwhelming gratitude towards your presentation. And gratitude is one of those emotions that I think helps us value who we are and go forward in positive ways. So thank you. And I guess I'm feeling gratitude for the power of story and how story helps us then to be able to engage in conversations in meaningful and positive ways. And I have run into the analogies you used before, and I also have been challenged to improve how I use them. I had a couple sort of questions and comments. One was in terms of the gardener's story, I was noting that this time I was aware that another step or another way of talking about it then is, in what way do the flowers become the agents of action? And that's another way of us thinking about it. And then when I was thinking about the flowers as agents of actions, I was aware that I was thinking about what happens with the red flowers that are the ones that are struggling in the midst of the full box, and how that can then generate the pushback that helps that makes it harder to do the things we want to do. And I guess I was wondering, interested in your comments about those things. Thank you.
Thank you.
I too have great gratitude for you being here. I've been trying to teach your work for the past couple years. It's a great honor to hear you speak today. I am actually interested as also looking at the wonderful allegories you tell about how we can have the gardener attend to the issue intentionally. I think attend.
Oh, okay.
So I sort of feel like that we claim that we're interested in issues of health equity, but it's hard to keep it on the table and it keeps sliding off. And one tool that I became quite enamored with is something called the Equity and Empowerment Lens, developed by the city of Portland, Multnomah County, and I had an opportunity to hear them speak, and actually was intrigued to find that their material is now on the American Public Health Association website. I don't know of any models within healthcare where we're applying this tool, but it provides a lens as by way we can structurally really attend to issues of equity. And so I was wondering how you as the president are trying to disseminate that information. I don't actually have any formal teaching tools with how to do it, but I'm really intrigued by that particular model. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your inspired story. It'll help us all. I just wanted to ask you one question, which is, we just concluded a one-hour discussion on single payer. And it's hard to get any agreement on this issue. But we concluded that what we really were talking about is universal health care. And how do we get all the factions of people interested in achieving universal health care? And we decided that the common denominator, the common motivator for all of it, is health equity.
Is?
Health equity.
Yeah.
And if you had to answer this question, what would you believe to be the next step? How do we bring people together to work collectively towards that? Is it educational? Is it political? Is it just a lot of people working together in whatever ways we can?
Okay.
Tough question, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But if we would appreciate any help you have.
Thank you for your presentation. What I am noticing is, as we think about the need to facilitate the conversation around transparency, we need to know better where our levers are. Where are our PowerPoints to really facilitate the conversations that will lead to change? And one of the levers that we have as an organization, many people in STFM teach family medicine clerkships, where we have the chance to facilitate conversations and understanding with all future physicians of all specialties. This message was so clearly and respectfully crafted that this message belongs in all of our clerkships.
Okay, let me get those.
The clerkships have a national set of competencies, and disparities of health are on that list. So we would love to work with whatever, what can we do to get some good version of this available to all our clerkships?
Good morning. I'm a clinic director, and I wanted to share a situation and see if I could get some thoughts about it. The other day, one of my providers came up to me and said, you know, I can't see this patient. I went in, and he is just complaining about waiting for 4 hours, and just he won't engage with me. So I go in to see the patient. He has been waiting a long time. I see that he's a young black man with dreads, very upset, and there's a security guard standing by the exam room door. And in our facility, it's the sheriff's department that does the security. So I call the security guard away. I sit down with him, apologize, and then get somebody to see him. And then I realized there's probably something else, there's something else I should have done about that situation, mm-hmm. and do the things that you had just mentioned at the end. What would be the best ways for me to call racism in a situation where there are people who don't see it?
Hello, thank you so much for speaking to us today. My question kind of follows up similarly to that previous one. I'm wondering, how do you talk to people who don't believe that social determinants of health exist or that racism exists? And they feel, oh, well, there are Latinos and Asian Americans who seem to have better health outcomes. Why don't we study them and see what they're doing instead of, you know, investing money in these other things? Thank you.
So thank you for coming. You've always been a guiding light as a physician, and I'm glad to see you in charge of the APHA and this national campaign against racism. I was hoping you could just touch on that third part of dismantling the conveyor belt, which is organizing, and speak a little bit to how we can get out of our clinics and out of our universities and work with the community to actually organize against this. Thank you.
Thank you all for your questions. So I'm going to do a blitz answer, so I hope I do justice. So already the first question, I put this up about the Anti-Racism Collaborative. The healing process, and for white people who are corrupted, I am clear when I talk to people, I already started with you all, that racism I'm not seeing as an individual character flaw or personal moral failing. It's a system. And so when I use an example, say that you live near a cement factory that was spewing cement dust, if you were there long enough, you know, 6 months, you'd have cement dust in your lungs. And it's not blaming you, you know, it's something there. But what you have to do if you don't want cement dust in your lungs is put on a gas mask that has become actively anti-cement dust or anti-racist. But then your other job is not just to do that as an individual, but to organize with other people so you can shut down the cement factory. So I let people know I'm not in the business of saying who's racist or who's not. We all have been impacted by racism. Most of my cement dust is against me and people who look like me. But we all have this cement dust. And so what we need to do is be very clear that racism is a system. When you put it like that, then people who might be feeling shame or guilt or whatever say, oh, but now I have a role. I have an active role to dismantle this system. So they can turn their shame or guilt into action. So the interprofessional education and using these same approaches. The main thing is to value, I would say, I would take the three axes, you know, the three principles for achieving health equity, valuing all individuals and populations equally. Well, how do you do that in an interprofessional context, really? Recognizing and rectifying historical injustice and current injustices, even in terms of practice, ability, and stuff like that, and providing resources according to need. I think that those principles could be applied there. We need to value one another equally, and we don't need turf wars. And so I think that that's my quick answer there. How to build inclusive programs. Oh yeah, when like the providers of color cry because nobody cared when you kept seeing these unanswered police killings and stuff like there. So how could we partner with APHA? I would say of those seven collective action teams, probably liaison and partnership. Is because I think what we're going to try to do there is identify on the ground programs that are trying to do action and link them up with one another in a network. But it is distressing when people don't see your pain. I really think that the dual reality story, which I haven't published in a peer-reviewed journal, but it is in the March, it's my president's column in the March 2016 The Nation's Health, that's the APHA newspaper. Also, you can find it in TEDx Emory. If you Google Kamara Jones TEDx Emory, there's a little TEDx talk where I present that. I think that that gives people tools there, but I think that dual reality is a winner. It's going to be the next Gardner's Tale. Power of story. When do the red flowers become agents, and especially the red flowers who aren't doing that well, and they might resent. This is how I interpreted the question. The red flowers might resent any attention to pink when they say, well, I'm read, but that doesn't mean I'm doing well or whatever. It's an issue. The main thing is getting the attention of the gardener, and to the extent that the gardener is duping the red flowers who aren't doing as well by saying, well, at least you're red, you know, I mean, it's the same thing that's divided labor unions and lots of people, you know, around real struggle. So it's my quick answer there. How can we attend to issues? I like that question. How do we attend to issues? How do we not just address them and then let them slip off? Well, actually, I didn't know that the Equity and Empowerment Lens materials were on the APHA website. So thank you for bringing that to my attention, and I'll try to figure out how to disseminate that information. I need to study that more, and maybe I can incorporate it in some of the stuff I do as I talk all around the country. So somebody was saying about universal health care and then health equity was the thing, but how do we bring folks together? As I see it, there are three huge cultural challenges that we have in this nation for achieving health equity. One is that we're ahistorical. So we think that the current distribution of goods and services is happenstance, makes structures and systems irrelevant, right? And, you know, like pull yourself up by your bootstraps. So we need to address that. The second is that we have a very profound focus, narrow focus on the individual, which again makes structures and systems irrelevant, not invisible, but kind of irrelevant. And then the third is this myth of meritocracy, that if you work hard, you'll make it. Well, most people who've made it have worked hard. Not everybody who's made it has worked hard, but most have. But there are many, many other people who are working just as hard or harder who will never make it because of an uneven playing field. We need to address that. And so part of the addressing it is bursting through bubbles. This is going to be the answer to almost all of the next questions. Okay, so she's about to hook me off. We need to burst through bubbles. Each of us is in our own bubble. We need to go across town and see there are people who is just as hard, working, kind, funny, generous, smart as we are, who live in very different circumstances. And in our practices, we burst bubbles with individuals, but we need to create opportunities, structural opportunities to burst bubbles by having schools partner or whatever. Again, bursting bubbles on the patient who is waiting for hours, and how do you call out racism? It's hard, but I do it by asking questions. Why did you feel the need, security guard, to stand outside that door? Why did you not understand the real, you know, that this patient had been waiting a long time? When you ask questions, you don't say, that was a racist thing to do. You just ask questions, and hopefully people can reflect, but at least you've made them think and uncomfortable. How do you talk to folks that think that social determinants of health and racism don't exist? Well, some of my allegories, again, so I recommend that you look at those are tools. All of the things that I said are tools. And so the TEDx talk and also the Gardener's Tale. If you Google Kamara Jones Gardener's Tale, there's an 18-minute video on the City Match website that's really good. And then organizing and strategizing to act, use the concluding observations from the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination as an organizing tool. It's 14 pages. There's something for everybody, just one paragraph for everybody. You can take that into communities and we can start organizing. So thank you very much.
Please join me. Thank you, Harry. Two things. I know you've been inspired. This has been amazing for us, but we do need to go see our posters because the folks have worked hard. But if you want to continue this conversation, Marquette 6 at 3:30 this afternoon, there will be a workshop on racism. So please join me one more time in thanking Dr. Jones.
Thank you.